can read a passage from Third Helpings for us.
This is from a chapter called Just Try It, about my little girl Sarah, who's 11. She's kind of a finicky eater. What I decided to tell Sarah about catfish was that it tastes like flounder. She eats flounder, although I can't say she's an enthusiast. When it comes to food, her enthusiasm runs toward chocolate. Her favorite dish, if that's the word, being a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles. She once went to the village Halloween parade as a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles, the ultimate tribute. I can't remember what I told her flounder tastes like. Whatever it was must have been mentioned in a speech of considerable eloquence. Sarah does not taste casually. When she does take a bite, she chews it slowly. It's what we call a microbite, a very small bite, and then says something like, "It's okay, but I'm not crazy about it." There is general agreement in our family that my speeches on how closely Chinese fried dumplings resemble ravioli were as persuasive as any I have delivered. Sarah happens to love ravioli. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see her suit up as a ravioli some Halloween. But 4 years of such speeches were required before Sarah agreed to take one microbite of one dumpling. Trying to persuade Sarah to taste something is not a struggle that is undertaken in the expectation that success will be rewarded with the opportunity to see her yelp with joy as she cleans her plate. She's not likely to be crazy about it. Once Alice used a food processor and cream cheese and absolutely fresh spinach and considerable imagination to turn out a spinach dish, one bite of which would have probably caused Paul Bocuse to ask about the possibility of apprenticing for a while in Alice's kitchen. Sarah tasted the spinach and, displaying a certain sensitivity toward the feelings of the chef, said, "It's better than a carrot." I must admit that the chef and I have found that phrase useful ever since. As we walk out of a movie, one of us sometimes says, "Well, it was better than a carrot," or occasionally, "That one was not quite as good as a carrot."
Thanks for reading that. It's a selection from Third Helpings, Calvin Trillin's new book. I think of you as being a kind of populist gourmet. Do you think that we're paying too much attention to fancy, expensive, exotic foods?
I think probably less attention than was once paid in some ways. I think around the country, if I come into town, I'm now less likely to be taken to that fancy gourmet restaurant on top of the bank building I used to call La Maison de la Casa House Continental Cuisine, where their notions about continental cuisine, I believe, were derived from some knowledge of the Continental Trailway Bus Company. and more likely to be taken to a place that has some sort of regional or local specialty. Of course, on the other hand, there the interest in cooking and gadgets and that sort of thing is greater than ever. I suspect that's just a way to sell Christmas presents in some ways. And the interest in American food on a kind of gourmet level is higher than ever. One of the theories about that, I think, is that they simply have run out of countries. That you just can't have a Bloomingdale's promotion on Bloomingdale's Celebrates Chad or something like that. There's a limit to the number of countries you can do, and I think they finally ran out and are using this one.
Do you think fast food franchises are driving out regional foods?
In some places, that's true. If I remember once I was in Cahokia, Missouri on a story, which is in the northeast corner of Missouri, in kind of a remote part in the sense that it's very far from everything that counts in the state, the capital and the university and all that. Actually, it's not important enough to be on the map. I think it's Esso, or one of the places actually puts its logo over Cahokia on the map. But they had a wonderful restaurant where all the farmers ate when they came in for lunch, fresh vegetables and everything. And I realized that one of the reasons it was there was Cahokia was too small to have a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Once they got it, the place probably wouldn't be able to compete with it just on all this portion control of selling hamburgers in shape of a clown or something, you know, pull kids in with their parents, all this stuff. But the places with strong traditions still have the places. I mean, I don't think you could come into Philadelphia and start a national and open a branch of a national franchise cheesesteak place and expect very many Philadelphia people to be loyal to it. They would say it's not cheesesteak.
I think at the same time that people are becoming involved with good foods, that there's this incredible diet craze going on, and it seems to be a kind of basic schizophrenia of the American personality, this urge for, like, the best foods, and there are even people who, like, vomit after they eat to...
Right.
It's a craze now, apparently, to, like, get rid of
I think maybe
the
be less of a
eaten.
Craze than a disease, that
sort
right, of thing.
That's right, a disease, yes.
Well, I think one of the things that happens is instant communication in this country, so that if somebody invents a diet, he markets it immediately, and within a few weeks, it's everywhere, and it's that week's fad, and then 4 weeks later, it's forgotten. I'm not sure that many more people actually are dieting at one time, and that's a little bit true of the food business too. As everything is promoted so quickly and spread so quickly, that it sometimes seems to be changing more than it really is.
You have a great piece in Third Helpings about someone in a small town in Louisiana, a former head of the Chamber of Commerce, who wanted to convert his town to the Pritikin diet.
Yeah, it was Natchitoches, Louisiana, which is it's a northern Louisiana town, but with some southern Louisiana overtones. The southern Louisiana, I believe the governor said when he opened this, what they call research project, that would have been too much of a test. So southern Louisiana is dominated by Cajuns who are very interested in eating. In fact, the governor is a Cajun himself, the one who was in power then. And even at the opening banquet of this great experiment, he said, even though it's a noble experiment, he personally would rather die 10 years early than eat that sort of thing. So it was kind of a schizophrenic situation. I interviewed some of the Kiwanis members who told me while sitting behind these plates piled high with pork chops and stuffed everything and potatoes that they thought some people were using less salt now that it had started, but I didn't see much effect.
What's the regional cuisine in that part, Natchitoches?
Well, oddly enough, they have a real specialty called Natchitoches meat pies, which used to be sold on the streets years ago, and then they're the sort of thing that if you have a party in Natchitoches, you go to one of the meat pie ladies and have her meat pie. And then finally, someone opened a meat pie restaurant, which has been very successful. And in fact, the fellow who runs it, Lazion is his name, told me he had had his best year ever because he'd had a lot of publicity. Because anybody who was in town watching the solemn thesis of Pritikin on one hand obviously had to go check out the cheery antithesis of Lazion's meat pies on the other. He was somebody who did serve vegetables, but if he put okra on the menu, he took the trouble to deep fry it. He was somebody who I think didn't think much of the health food craze, which of course made him a soulmate for me.
You don't think much of it either.
Well, I have a personal problem with it. It happens to make me sick. I mean, it actually makes me feel a little queasy to eat that stuff. And also, when I'm in one of those stores, there's that odd smell that makes me think I've been trapped in a Corsiden bottle that's been left in the medicine cabinet for some reason. And also, the one most overwhelming piece of logic about the whole thing is, if it's so good for you, how come the people who work in the stores look so awful? They are really some of the worst-looking people in the world, kind of pasty-faced guys with scraggly beards and sunken chests. And so it seems to me if stump paste and soy waste and all that stuff they eat is so good for you, why can't they grow full beards? I mean, it just stands to reason they would look better. So I think it's a good argument for cheesesteaks and hoagies, all those places.
Do you ever worry about your cholesterol? Since you have to and want to sample all this rich food so frequently?
Well, I mean, I don't just although it may be rumored that I do, I don't just eat pure lard for breakfast or anything like that. But also, it seems to me that if you're someplace once a year and you want to get the specialty that place, that it'd be pretty silly to worry about what damage it's going to do your body.
So how did Pritikin end up catching on in Natchitoches, Louisiana?
I would say not catching on would be probably... they did sell some of that special bread at the supermarket, but I asked the guy who baked it if he ate it, and he said no. And then I said, have you ever tasted it? And he said, yes. I said, what does it taste like? And he said, cardboard. And I tried it, and I thought it tasted like cardboard with a slight aftertaste. The people there, I think, were not the right sort of people. I think he could have done better with maybe some people in a fancy club in New England or something who eat food that doesn't have any taste to start with.
Well, you not only dislike the food recommended on the Pritikin diet, I think you distrust Pritikin as well.
Well, I'm not to say the very least, I'm not a nutritionist, and I don't, or a doctor. Of course, he's not a nutritionist or doctor either. But and it's quite possible, I keep telling myself, that it may be that when the deity decides to send the truth to the world, I mean, cap the truth, not just the truth about diet, but the truth about everybody, everything, he may select as his messenger a Southern California health guru with movie stars as disciples and books on the bestseller list, because God, we are taught, works in strange and mysterious ways. But until it's proven to me, it's hard to believe that that's actually how we're going to get the truth.
Calvin Trillin is my guest, if you're just joining us. Have you noticed that there are, I'm sure you have, that there's a bunch of new foods that have been invented lately, like deep dish pizza and potato skins with cheese on it, which is very popular in Philadelphia now. Let's start with the deep dish pizza, which... Seems relatively new to me.
It's from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago is known for doing all kinds of tap dancing with what other people think of as a rather straightforward business of turning out pizzas. And they invented the double crust pizza and the Chicago pizza and the deep dish pizza and all that. And in fact, they've exported it. You can now go to London and go to a Chicago pizza parlor where very... respectable-looking English gentlemen are sitting under posters urging another term for Richard Daley, and listening, or at least claiming, or at least seeming to listen to the Chicago Cubs game on tape. So it's very odd. I don't know what happened to potato. There used to be that you got potato skins in certain restaurants, usually restaurants I found that where I didn't like much else, kind of. Prime ribs restaurants, that they were just the skin and nothing else and no cheese or anything and just flash fried in oil, very deep fried, I mean, without any bat or anything like that. And I really loved them. They, of course, also used to wonder what happened to the inside of the potato. My wife's theory was, you know, all parents try to tell their kids that the skin of the potato is actually the part they should eat and has all the food value and everything, and all parents fail to get their children to eat the outside of the potato. So her theory was that they just went around collecting all the potato skins from all the children's plates all over this town. But since then, people have started loading it up first with cheese, and then they leave a little more of the potato on. It's become kind of a bar food you get in saloons that are kind of trendy saloons. And in a way, the same thing happened to the whole potato, where baked potato, where people for a while put butter on it, which seemed for probably hundreds of years, people just put butter on it. And then they started putting sour cream and chives and then bacon bits. And then that seemed to last for a long time. And suddenly, somebody broke through the bacon bit barrier. It was kind of the way Roger Bannister broke through the four-minute mile, and suddenly everybody was doing four-minute miles. And once they broke through the bacon bit barrier, there seemed nothing they wouldn't put inside a potato in one of those places that have names like Meal and Appeal or something like that. All sorts of chicken, parmesan, all sorts of things. I mean, I think green jello mold inside of a potato is just around the corner, probably.
Sometimes when they put cheese on either cheese fries or on the potato skins, it's the fake cheese?
Right. It's stuff that looks like cheese. What they call, I think, a
cheese-like
substance.
Oh, yes, imitation cheese.
Cheese-like substance in the dietitian's convention.
Have you ever bit into something thinking you were going to get cheese and it was the artificial cheese? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I think it depends on who's looking.
Say it's safe.
Right.
Would you complain if they didn't tell you that you weren't getting the real thing?
Oh, yeah. I complain at restaurants a lot. I just say, this isn't any good, or this isn't hot, or this isn't... One time in New York, I ordered an oyster loaf in a restaurant that was supposedly specializing in regional American food. An oyster loaf is one of the great dishes of New Orleans, which for some reason isn't made anywhere else, although anybody could make it. You could have an oyster loaf very easily in Philadelphia. What it is six or eight really good oysters, which you can get good oysters practically anywhere, and deep fried, and then put on what looks like a loaf from a cheesesteak or a hoagie with a little lettuce and things. It's a great dish. And I ordered one in New York, and it came, and I opened the roll, and there wasn't an oyster inside. There was nothing. You know, there was a little residue. It looked like some animal had crept through or something. It wasn't actually anything there, and I thought it was a mistake. I gave it back to the waitress, and she took it back, and she came back with another one. Same thing. I said, have people actually been paying all since you've been here for this? It just astounded me. I think people should yell in restaurants and shout, you know. I don't think they should flip butter or anything like that.
In New York, where you live, as in Philadelphia, there's a lot of Korean and Vietnamese immigrants who have been opening up restaurants. How is that affecting the New York food life? Do you go to a lot of the Vietnamese and Korean restaurants?
We don't have as many Vietnamese restaurants as some people do. I was just in Washington, and they had a lot of those. The Koreans have been less active in the restaurant business in New York than they have in the produce stand, fruit and vegetable, which has helped a lot. I mean, there's practically no place in New York and Manhattan now where you can't, within a block or two, be in two or three, sometimes all night, produce places. Well, I think that confirms my view, and I'm occasionally accused of being insufficiently intense about political issues. There is nobody more passionate than I as a defender of the liberalization of immigration laws. I'm all for that. The more people you let in, the more restaurants you have. It's perfectly obvious. The only people I wouldn't let in would be the English. Otherwise, I think we'd have an English quota of about 6-7 people a year. And turn the other quotas toward the people who can cook. I was the only one, when they had those television pictures when Saigon fell and the helicopter was hovering over the American compound, I was shouting at the television, said, get the chefs, get the chefs, get them on board. And I don't know how they would tell if somebody could cook, but in New York, for instance, Chinatown, which when I came back to New York from the South 20 years ago was really drying up, is now a marvelous place with all kinds of things to eat. It's because of the change in the immigration laws.
Yeah, you went to China. Well, to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. Wasn't interested in going to China. I was told that if you were below presidential level, ironically, the person who got fed all of these banquets was the president who revealed himself openly as someone who ate cottage cheese with ketchup at his desk. At least at the beginning of the term, I don't know if you noticed, but toward the end of his term, they were saying he simply ate cottage cheese. He didn't use the ketchup anymore. It's what they mean by growing in the presidency. He didn't need the ketchup. But otherwise, I was told that the food wasn't all that good, because I knew a lot of Chinatown freaks who went immediately to the mainland when it opened for tourism, willing to endure all kinds of lectures about bicycle plants and primary schools just for a crack at the food. And it turned out it was disappointing. So I've always thought of Hong Kong as the perfect place, since it has ingredients from the mainland, and it is just chock full of capitalist running dogs of imperialist lackeys who are willing to pay almost anything for a dish of food. So it's a very nice combination.
How did the food compare with Chinatown?
I have to say it was just a tiny bit better. People usually say that Hong Kong, Taiwan, and New York Chinatown are the three best places in the world to eat Chinese food. And, of course, New York Chinatown is the only one that's within a bicycle ride of my house, so I spend a lot of time down there. But I do spend a lot of time longing for Hong Kong. The one thing they have in Chinatown that I couldn't find in Hong Kong is the chicken that plays tic-tac-toe. Do you have any of those here?
No. What's that?
Well, in a place called... it's now called something like the Chinese Amusement Arcade. It used to be called the Chinese Museum, and I actually saw tourists getting out of cabs in front of it, hoping to get a little culture, but the only kind of culture they would get would be Pac-Man or something like that. But they have one machine, which is a live chicken that plays tic-tac-toe, and there's a electronic board on the outside of it, of the cage, that where you get the X's and he gets the O's, or vice versa, and it says either your turn or sometimes it says bird's turn, and you get a huge sack of fortune cookies if you beat the chicken. But I've never seen anybody beat the chicken. The chicken, some people think that the chicken knows which square to peck because there's some lights that light up from a computer. But some people think he is just one smart chicken, a really trained up chicken, chicken that's about as well trained as you could get a chicken. I like to go there after a Chinese meal, try my hand. I'm not a sore loser, I don't mind. I've never come anywhere near beating him. But other than that, and then I have a kind of a nostalgic feeling about New York Chinatown. But Hong Kong Chinatown is the whole city, which is a great advantage. I mean, my wife keeps saying you can't have Chinese meals 2 or 3 days in a row, but there are a billion people who have 3 Chinese meals a day think nothing of it. I'm not even counting the overseas Chinese. There are a billion people. Nobody says, we're not going to eat Chinese again today, are we? They say, well, however you say, of course, silly, in Chinese, they say.
Do the restaurants in Hong Kong serve egg rolls and egg foo young yet, since there's probably a lot of American tourists who expect to find that at a Chinese restaurant?
None of them I went to, but I suspect that you could probably find some in the hotel. To my astonishment, there were people walking around Hong Kong, obvious tourists, with bulging shopping bags. They had come there to shop. I mean, I had come to eat, and I didn't understand that anybody would come there for any other reason. So they have a lot of restaurants and shopping malls, and I suppose some of them must serve that sort of thing. Or they may have that Chinese restaurant. I think it's in San Francisco. There's a Chinese fast food place called Yangtze Doodle. They may have a couple of branches over there.
Do you know the Shanghai restaurant in Brooklyn?
No. The Shanghai restaurant is that's kosher Chinese.
It's kosher Chinese.
You know, there's always been a kosher Chinese restaurant in New York called, there was Bernstein's on Essex. It simply didn't have a Chinese name. But then now they've come with great names. I didn't know about the Shanghai, but I did. There's none called Moishe Peking. And one of the great restaurant names I heard was in Los Angeles. There's a sort of Mexican fast food, although it's better than fast food, but it's done in that sort of atmosphere. It's a way of grilling chicken. They split a whole chicken and marinate it in some secret business, and then grill it while basting it on what seems to be about an acre of grill in the back of these restaurants, and you see these guys with long sticks turning them over. And all the restaurants, there are several chains, they're all named Pollo something that have to do with chicken. The one we went to is called Pollo Loco, and we passed one called Pollo Macho, but this I was taken there by a columnist from the Herald Examiner, Carol Crotta, and she said that her favorite name was too far to go. It was in Torrance. It's called Marco Pollo.
Oh, no.
It's pretty good, I thought.
What's your native cuisine?
Oh, well, leftovers, actually, I suppose. My mother, for about 20 or 30 years, served our family nothing but leftovers. And it wasn't until I got into college that I started wondering, leftover from what? We now have a team of anthropologists in there trying to find out when the original meal was. I suppose leftovers would be my native cuisine.
Did you have canned foods?
Oh, yeah. Well, not only did we have canned foods, but for much of my childhood, my father was in the grocery business. So we had canned foods that didn't have any labels on them. The cans that lost their labels and couldn't sell them. So my father would bring them home. So we would have a nice can of whatever it turned out to be.
Did your mother use spices?
Not many spices, no. I think somehow she got the idea that there was something wrong with spices, and that if she was going to raise us in a kind of upwardly mobile fashion, that she would leave out the spices. And she even got the idea somehow that there was something slightly déclassé about putting schmaltz in chicken liver, in chopped chicken liver, which meant that her chopped chicken liver tasted pretty much like green Jell-O or something like that. She was confused about those issues. But we had good things to eat. I mean, I was in Kansas City. We had good barbecue and wonderful fried chicken. So there were good things to eat.
Are you Jewish?
Yeah.
Which part did you come from? Where did you say it was?
Missouri.
Yeah, I don't think of there being much kind of like bagels and lox and schmaltz herring and matzah out there.
Oh, yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. there's not much of that stuff, no. I didn't know that things like shellfish weren't kosher until I got to the East, because I never saw one. So it is kind of odd.
Have you ever been to a Jewish wedding where they serve you kosher cheesecake after the meat meal that's all chemicals? I mean, there's no milk or cheese in it, which is why it's
no.
The kosher cheesecake.
I'm not sure if I've ever been to a kosher wedding. I saw somebody yesterday in Washington who grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home in New Orleans, and they cooked what they called kosher Cajun food, and with all these fantastic dishes that were where they somehow substituted for the oysters. I didn't even want to ask him what they substituted for the oysters and shrimp, and you know, there's tremendous.
Probably soy.
That's right. There's a restaurant in New York called the Parkway. It moved uptown since then, but it used to be in the Lower East Side, which served Romanian Jewish cooking. I don't know if you have one of those in Philadelphia, but it's a Romanian Jewish cooking has to do, I think, basically with a fear of vampires. The Romanian Jewish restaurant actually has schmaltz, liquid chicken fat, on the table in a dispenser, in the way you might have nice syrup in some nice New England restaurant, and has seltzer water on the table. And, of course, then they use a tremendous amount of garlic to try to keep the vampire away. That's the Romanian part. But then if he gets through the garlic defense, you hit him with a schmaltz and give him heartburn. So you're absolutely safe from vampires when you're in one of those places. But it's very heavy cooking. The great line about it was Zero Mostel's line, when he said, it's killed more Jews than Hitler. I did a story on it once. They had singing waiters one time. They had a strolling accordionist who would play on Saturday night, but they also had singing waiters. One of them was a belt-em-out singer, as he always put it, who would have to put the dirty dishes down because he needed both hands to sing. He sang kind of Jolson songs and the cabaret song, that sort of thing. And the other guy was called the Goyish Waiter. He was one of those guys. Like many people, he had come to New York to be an actor. Most waiters and waitresses in New York. A friend of mine was interviewing people to be waitresses in a bar he was opening, and they were all actresses. And finally he said, "This is not a play about a bar. It's a bar." I mean, it's very confusing. But this guy obviously never got any roles. He would have played the kind of playboy son if he had gotten a role, the kind of tennis anyone part. But he was aging from that. Had a wonderful stage diction accent, would sing songs like If You Love Me and with a Song in My Heart, and would bring the mashed potatoes and hold the schmaltz up with one hand over it and the gribbiness with the other and say, "May I?" But what reminded me of that is that I went to interview the chef, and the chef turned out to be Puerto Rican. And I said, "Isn't it difficult for a Puerto Rican to cook Romanian Jewish food?" And he said, "No, there was this color guy here who taught me." So we had to do some of that in Kansas City. However, the great advantage of being from an immigrant family I mention in the first chapter about changing the National Thanksgiving Day dish from turkey to spaghetti carbonara. When people say, but our forebears did not eat spaghetti carbonara in the first Thanksgiving meal, I can say one of the things I always give thanks for on Thanksgiving is those people were not my forebears. I mean, who wants forebears who, you know, put people in the stocks for a suspicion of cheerfulness and that sort of thing, came to this country for freedom to nag? And also, one of the great advantages of being from a family that never saw the place or perhaps never heard of it until the 20th century is that all this, all the land that was snookered from the Indians and the buffalo slaughtered and everything, we had nothing at all to do with that. Our family's hands are clean when it comes to that rapacious 19th century capitalism, the Civil War, slavery, you name it. We've had nothing to do with it. I would say the only people slightly more innocent than we are those Koreans who run the fruit and vegetable stand, because they're not even responsible for the Vietnam War. They just got here. And that's one of the reasons that I'm not really stuck on turkey. I figured I had nothing to do with those people anyway.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and in those couple of minutes, there's two things that I'd like to ask you about. One is which places you like to eat in when you come to Philadelphia, and then finally, who some of your favorite writers are, since I like your writing very much. I'd like to know who you read.
Well, I've just really gotten to Philadelphia so hard, and I was
with the first question.
And we did an interview with at Pat's Steaks, and I do like cheesesteaks. I mean, I like cheesesteaks. I like kind of Philadelphia specialties, partly because it's one of the places where people take them seriously enough so that you find arguments about them. So that naturally, the cab driver who took me to Pat's told me it wasn't any good and I should eat somewhere else, and which is usually the sign of something that people take seriously enough so that there's a critical clientele. By favorite writers, you mean, I mean, what sort of writers? Novelists or humorists or?
How about some of both? Yeah. Novelists, humorists,
well,
and essayists.
I think of the people who write, humorist, now that I've used it, I have to say I find a little uncomfortable word. Ring Lardner was asked by his son why he never described himself as a humorist, and he said, it's as if someone asked you what you did for a living and you said, I'm a great third baseman. I mean, it assumes that somebody's laughing. But the people I laugh at, I like Russell Baker a lot, and Roy Blunt, I think, is very funny. And Peter DeVries sometimes makes me laugh out loud, and he thinks of things that I think a lot of people would... He just throws away things a lot of people would build whole books around. I think Mordecai Rischler is very funny. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. He did a wonderful book called St. Urban's Horseman. I think one of the funniest books I've ever read. A novelist, and I suppose my favorite prose writer, who's not a novelist, is a man named Joseph Mitchell, who has written for years for The New Yorker and has written very little in the last 20 years since I've been there. Some of his books are, I guess his best known book is a book called McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, written a lot about New York. And I think a lot of people who try to write magazine nonfiction admire him more than they do just about anybody. I like all sorts of novels. I sometimes like mysteries. I think the 175-page well-written paperback mystery was put on earth to lighten the load of the traveling man going from one city to the other. There's some novelists like whose books I always read. Anne Tyler, for instance, I love her stuff. And it's hard for me to tell because I live in New York, and some people write novels and I know them, I automatically read it because I know them, and it's hard to separate. It's sometimes even hard to separate because sometimes I know the characters. It makes it even worse. But I'm reading all sorts of different things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I enjoy your writing, and I'm really glad you were able to come here for this interview today. Thank you.
Thank you.